From Beyond Marketing, it's the 20-Minute Call, a podcast about the dreamers, boundary pushers, rebels, and champions of the skydiving industry. Each episode is a narrative journey highlighted by the highs, lows, and luck that the skydiving industry delivers, as told by the most influential people within the sport. If you've ever dreamed of becoming a skydiver, perhaps opening a drop zone, or becoming the next world champion, check out the 20-Minute Call hosted by me, James LeBarry. My guest today is one of the great people of our sport. Hailing from Melbourne, Australia, Rob Delaney and his wife Shelley founded Manufactory, one of the leading skydiving apparel brands in the world today. Their company builds jerseys, jumpsuits, swoop shorts, and so much more for major brands like the Red Bull skydiving team, and competition teams like Airwax, SDC Core, and drop zones like Skydive Spaceland, Skydive Moab, and many others. Aside from being brilliantly talented at what he does, Rob is passionate about all manner of air sports, ranging from skydiving to paragliding. Whenever I see Rob and his wife Shelley at PIA symposiums, it's like a happy reunion, as Rob radiates positive vibes. Welcome to the 20-Minute Call, my friend, Rob Delaney. How are you, Rob?
I'm good. Thank you, James. I'm very happy to be here. Positive vibes turned on.
Positive vibes turned on. I love it. Cool. Well, Rob, for those that are unfamiliar with you, tell us a little bit about your background. Where are you from? Do you have siblings? Are you an only child? What's your story?
Yeah, sure. So Melbourne, Australia, that is down the very bottom in the cold. It's very cold down here most of the year. 9 months of the year, I'd say it's cold. And a lot of people reference Melbourne especially within Australia, as a very fashionable culture area of the country. We're the second largest city. Now, I didn't grow up in Melbourne exactly. I grew up outside of Melbourne, down in the suburbs, about 45 minutes between Melbourne and 45 minutes between the beach. I am the eldest child of two other boys and a sister, and was raised basically by my mother. My father passed away when I was in my early teens. So grew up with a very European background family, and that definitely influenced a lot, I would say. And then when I turned 13, after playing some baseball, basically, for a few years there, I got into surfing. Now, I was 45 minutes from the beach as the crow flies, and it took me about 3 hours then by public transport, which I did twice a week. Every weekend for the next 4 years until I got myself a car. And basically surfing is where I really am at home. I live now in Ocean Grove, which I'm a few hundred meters from the beach. I'm actually only less than a few kilometers from my home drop zone. It's amazing. It's a place where Shelley actually grew up, and she's been here her whole life. And actually her grandfather has very very, very strong roots in this town. We're here because it's a very community-based town, and we love it aside from 9 months of cold weather. We're very close to Melbourne, which keeps us tied into a lot of good restaurants, good culture, good fashion, but it's definitely where we've chosen to live, coming back from around the world and skydiving from a lot of places too.
Okay, a couple of things from what you said there that caught me off guard. Baseball, I didn't even know they played baseball in Australia.
Yeah, right. Like, it's basically, it's one of those things. So I was doing martial arts at a younger age, did it for a few years, and then just wanted to grow out. Everyone around high school is like, hey, what are they doing now? The default is to play Aussie rules, like football. Maybe if you're in another state, not Victoria, you would play rugby. But yeah, I don't know how it got into baseball, but when I did, and to this day, I love it. I absolutely love it. I will still watch it all the time. It's funny, I don't find it like a team sport. I feel like statistically it has grown so much and evolved that it's nine individuals that make up a team. Because, you know, when you play baseball, someone will say, or what position? So straight away, it's like, because your whole life is either you're a shortstop or a first baseman, like it's got its own identity. So it's so funny, even when you go to bat, it's an individual thing. So I find that baseball, as much as it's related to team sport, is a very individual sport too, and which sort of does fit well with me, because all the sports I've ever chosen are always individual off the back of that. So yeah, they do play it. We do happen to have an Australian make a US team every now and then, and it's the following it has in Australia is very much like Skydive Community, whereby once you're in it, like you're in it thick and thin. That's it. Like there's no you dabble in it sort of thing. So it's very cool. But I played that throughout my teens, 4 or 5 seasons before I got to a more adult life, especially my career, which definitely took me in other places there.
Okay, we're going to leave the topic of baseball. What is the team you follow in the U.S., or is it an Aussie team that you follow?
No, Chicago Cubs will always be the team. I was influenced by them from 13, and I happened to see them win their 2016 series. Like it was pretty impressive, yeah, with Cubs.
You know, interestingly, we are both from cricket playing countries. I'm from the Caribbean or the West Indies, and you being from Australia. But when I was a kid, we had maybe like 9 channels that we got in Antigua on television. And one of them was WGN, which carried Chicago Cubs baseball games. And that's the local, I don't know what affiliate, but in Chicago. So not that I was a big baseball fan, but I was very aware of the Chicago Cubs just by way of that one channel that we got to happen to show these baseball games. You mentioned you're into martial arts. I read that when you were a kid, you were fascinated by Bruce Lee. What's that about?
Oh, absolutely. I started martial arts. It was like the Taekwondo background. That sort of like what back then, I think it was Taekwondo and maybe another few martial arts, just being from a smaller suburb town, that's all that was really there at the time. And my instructors introduced me to like Bruce Lee books, and they were very taken by him and his style. So I read a lot and was just influenced by that. And even like to this day, my daughter, I think one of the first books we gave her was this little like Bruce Lee book, just on his life and how driven he was. So at an early age there in martial arts, later on in life, I took it past Taekwondo and I did a little bit of other jiu-jitsus and things while I was in my 20s. To this day, I did recently go to get back into it. And it was just different. I feel like I'd already visited that part of my life, and maybe I didn't. I felt personally like I'd visited. Yeah, that's right. I'd visited that part of my life. I didn't need to be back there again. So at this point in my life, I've moved forward from those things. Even though I do enjoy them, I do enjoy following them. I feel like I've been there, done that.
You know, as I mentioned in the introduction, you run with your wife Manufacturing. And when I think of someone who's truly suited for their profession, it's like you fit it perfectly. I read that when you were a teenager, I think when you were 16, you picked up a pair of scissors to make clothes and also started studying graphic design and visual arts. It seems like if you're going to have an apparel company making any kind of statement, these are the skills one should have. But how did you get into that interest of making clothes as a teenager?
Actually, it came from surfing. My mother has actually clothing and sewing. My mother, my grandmothers, they've all done it. I think it's quite typical in a lot of families like that, especially of our age. But when I got into surfing, I got really fascinated by wetsuits. I mean, everything, the smell of neoprene, you know, the petroleum, what they did, how they worked, and especially being surfing at that time. So I got into surfing at 13, and by 15, I think I'd hit year 9 in high school, so like a middle school area, but I knew straight away, like that's all I wanted to do was work at a local company, which is called Rip Curl Surfing, and they were down in Torquay, born and bred right next door to Quicksilver, and that's all I wanted to do. I knew it from 15, so I tailored every single pathway and subject within high school to get me through to fashion design. Finished high school. I went to an all-boys high school, so it wasn't easily accessible, any fashion subjects. We didn't have any textile subjects. That's not anything we had. And it was even difficult to ask teachers for pathways. They really didn't know where to go. So a lot of it was on finding my own. So I did every graphics, every visual arts, any subject I could do. And then my mother taught me to sew. And then basically I was off to college where I studied for a few years in fashion, which is everything from fashion design and drawing, computer-aided skills, pattern making, grading, everything from the ground up. These days they don't offer the courses anymore, and it's a real shame. I mean, for a country that's supposed to be trying to build its manufacturing, we don't even have the courses now to sort of aid people. So, basically I have known my whole life that I will be in clothing industry. And then after college, I went into learning it from the ground up from my first jobs.
Mate, let me pause you right there if you don't mind. Before we get into that part of it, what about wetsuits led you to this fascination in terms of their material and their smell and the, like, why was there such a connection with wetsuits? It seems so random to one that's not into it.
No, absolutely. And like, if these days the wetsuit smell, if you went into a store, won't be as strong. They've changed a lot of the manufacturing and the chemicals that go into them. But I was absolutely fascinated by something that was built for a specific purpose that helped you to do surfing. And to take it a step further, when I was in this younger period of my life that I was like, no, I'm going to be designing wetsuits and clothing, etc., I wasn't about I'm going to be designing T-shirts, for example, or you know, denim jeans. My career path chosen in my head was to tick a few boxes. Wetsuits was a big one. And then I was like, hey, this career path leads to if for example, I got to work, and I'll say it, but if I got to work with NASA on, I've researched it before, on the suits that astronauts wear. I know the companies that produce these and what goes into them, but that's what fascinates me. Something that has been built specifically to help us as a species survive in another area. So things that really drive me are the technical functional sides of fashion. I still love, don't get me wrong, like I know all the 90s fashion designers, models, I love runway shows, I love the beauty, the artistic, but I'm driven by function for sure.
And the goal was to work at Rip Curl, uh-huh, which is a major brand. I mean, even I have heard of Rip Curl. I'm not a surfer.
Yes, it's definitely a worldwide brand. Yep.
And you and your goal was met. You went and worked with Rip Curl for 3 years.
Yes, I actually think it was just under 4 or 5 there. But basically, I wanted to design wetsuits, which is extremely niche. And I got there with under 10 years. Not that a time frame was ever to be met, but by 24, I was on the wetsuit team, and I was in research and development and pattern making for making wetsuits. My days were made up of checking the sizes and the fits, and then literally making wetsuits by hand, samples, developments, coming up with these and then getting them into production. I worked under someone I respect a lot. His name was John Pyburn, or Sparrow was his nickname. He's got a surf spot named after him, and he worked with the company for over 60 years. He was there when they made wetsuits. He was an extremely innovative man, and I was very happy to work with him for a few years.
If you're a DZO or DZM listening to this podcast and you're not using Burble, I've got a question. Why not? If the reason is price, what's the cost of your time? Other booking and manifest softwares are a one-size-fits-all. Burble was built from the ground up by a DZO for DZOs to maximize efficiency. Now, isn't that nice? There's no software that compares. Choose Burble. Burble.
As an employer myself, you know, I'm looking for people that meet the skill set and do they have the right personality. And here's this young guy, you, rocking up to Rip Curl going, all I ever wanted to do was design, like, or be involved with the construction and design of, like, were they like, oh my God, who is this kid?
No. Dude, I had countless interviews at Rip Curl that I got knocked back for. I mean, like, oh, I would have gone for 6 or 7 positions there just to get in the door. The way I got in the door was through another lady I respect very much for giving me that break. Her name was Rihanna, and she was in the girlswear product development team, and she took a chance on a guy joining the girlswear team. And I still remember one day in our offices at Rip Curl, the CEO walked past us and he floated through, hey Rihanna, hey Susan, blah, 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 off he went. And she sort of went, that's strange. And I was like, well, you know, why? Now, the girlswear team was way out in the corners, like it was out. His office was way on the other side of the building. She said, I think, like, it just, he heard that I'd hired a guy for the girlswear team. So I put up with that sort of for a long time. It didn't bother me. If someone knew how to do the job, someone was passionate about clothes, and that's what I was saying. Hey, it doesn't matter if it's girlswear or boyswear or kidswear or menswear. Like, it's all clothes. It needs to be made the same way. I don't care what I'm making. I just want to work on it. So, yeah, she took a chance on me and broke into the girlswear team. And a few years later, I was a little bit sort of poached by the wetsuit team. So with the skill set I had mainly in pattern making and construction, wetsuits is very small. You know, around the whole world, there's wetsuit companies these days because of sourcing out of Asia, and a lot of wetsuit teams broke out to make more sustainable wetsuits, and people had their own influences and ideas, but they use each other for inspiration is a nice way to say it, and they don't even know what they're making pattern-wise. They wouldn't know how to cut it or sew it. That was the one thing I'm most proud of leaving that team is, like, from if you gave me a few sheets of neoprene today and the glue, I'll cut and sew it. I'll know exactly what I'm doing from there.
Interesting. Wow. I just assume you wouldn't think it'd be so hard when someone's so passionate about doing the thing that company does. I'm going to skip forward a little bit here because you did work at a few different jobs, but I know that in 2008 you made your first jump.
25.
You were age 25, is that right?
That was my birthday, 25th birthday.
So that was the reason for it, for going to jump.
It wasn't. There was actually personal circumstances led me to move away from that side of my life. Maybe it was a little bit that I achieved some of those goals very early. You know, like when you said, hey, you achieved it, and I say, yes, I did, and I did it in a time frame. It was very difficult. I don't want to belittle it, but at 25, I made some personal decisions. It was time to change course. I did my first skydive, and I did it more as a taste test. I'd known for about 5 years. I had some friends in the Australian Army that were into skydiving. I knew that it was a route I would take. I was sort of setting myself up for it. So when the opportunity came, I said, right, it's time to bite the bullet. Got the jump, went down, did the first jump, and actually the tandem master of that day who took me, Clayton Werner, he is still actually in my life. He is my best friend. I was the best man at his wedding. I know his whole family. We worked together in Dubai as well. 15 years later, we're still best friends and still skydiving together, and he was the guy who took me. So it was a big, big time and definitely a massive course correction. As you know, I'm here.
One of the things that I don't want to gloss over is you mentioned in your bio that one of the highlights of your skydiving career was jumping in a music video with a band called Skipping Girl Vinegar. And so I thought, well, that's very obscure. So I then went and looked up what is Skipping Girl Vinegar, which is a band named after a famous vinegar brand with an iconic sign. So I went down the rabbit hole, an iconic sign in, I suppose, near Melbourne. And then I watched the music video that you were in.
Yes.
And I'm having it in the show notes. I think that everyone listening should go and watch this. So is that you and your wife free flying in that video?
Yeah, that is. And it is, you should watch it just for the fun of skydiving. It was an opportunity that came up. So what happened is, yes, Skipping Girl Vinegar is an iconic neon sign down in Melbourne. Everyone has seen it that lives in the area. And there's a local band that was quite successful, and turned out that they lived just the suburb next door to us. One day, a friend, Macca Lee, who's a very distinguished, probably one of the best-known Australian skydivers, an extremely driven guy, he got a call. They wanted to shoot this music video and just needed some people. Now, Shell and I are both experienced free flyers and have the flexibility that we live down the drop zone, like, you know, 5 minutes away, and we could take a couple of days off to go jump, or a couple of hours. So Macca called us up and we said yes. We went and got fitted for gold jumpsuits, which we thought was fun for sure. And all we had to do, like, we did three or four jumps and Macca filmed it, and it was just a three-way, you know, me, Shell, and Macca. Macca actually started jumping a few years before me at a home drop zone, and we've all known each other, so it was just a bit of fun. We landed on the beach. If you watch the video, you're going to see my home drop zone and where we live. It doesn't get much better than that. I've actually, just behind the camera here is a print, like a canvas portrait of me and Shelley, a scene taken from that. It's over our coastline. I look at it every day. It was a highlight for sure. Like, who else gets to jump over their home drop zone, and then it gets put in a music video, which was made up to look really fun. It looks really cool, and we didn't know we were going to be stunt doubles. Not to spoiler alert there, but it's really cool. It's a fun video, and it was a great highlight for sure.
I was going to ask you if the gold suits were made by you. They're very exotic.
No, they weren't.
Very glamorous.
Yeah, they weren't. That was the thing. We got told, hey, you've got to go to Richmond and get this fitting. And when we rocked up, which was like a little bit of icing on the cake, really, because I got to see, it's very hard to find suppliers or factories around Melbourne and in the clothing industry. So when I walked in, you know, 10-meter-long cutting table with gold fabrics, and there's rolls of fabric everywhere. And then I was like, oh, we're in the clothing industry too. Blah, 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 blah. It was great. It was a really cool opportunity. The suits weren't made by us. They were just made. And even then, we were sort of like, you know, hey, well, hopefully these last more than a jump or two, because, well, they weren't purpose-built, were they? So, yeah, which is interesting now. With us making jumpsuits, we've made some more purposeful ones that would be able to replicate that video and stand the test of time. So,
for those listening, if you're thinking about skipping watching that video, don't, because what I was excited about is, as you all were taking off your helmets, I was excited to see who these jumpers were, assuming surely that it would be you. It was a very happy surprise to see who it was. So I will leave it there, as not to have a spoiler alert, but it was really, really good. You started manufacturing in 2014, but before we get there, you worked as a creative director at Scout of Dubai. And certainly sort of when it was in its heyday, when sort of all the world was like, whoa, what's going on in this place? Can you tell me a story? What was it that you did for Scout of Dubai, and what was that experience like?
Sure. So I'll start from the very start, actually. I had worked, like you mentioned before, quite a few jobs in fashion, and I'd worked in surfing, motocross, luxury fashion, fast fashion, and I had started skydiving and was pretty much enthralled by that. So fashion and clothing jobs at the time weren't filling the gap. Skydiving was. I was on dropzone.com and just scouting work. I was at a point where, like, I think a lot of jumpers get to, all right, am I going to go work in the industry, or am I going to just sports jump and fund it that way? But to the complete disbelief of my eyes, there was a graphic design position at Scout of Dubai. It was just so random. I had always dreamt of living and working in Dubai, but it was off the scope, because to do that, you had to be in a completely different industry, you know, mining or building or accounting, or, you know, something that wasn't open to me. So when I saw it, It was late at night. The very next day, I actually pulled out my phone and I did a selfie interview. So this is back in, this would have been 2009 or 10. So even then, like, who does a selfie interview? But I was like, what have I got to lose? These are just skydivers. And I did what we're doing right now. I spoke for a couple of minutes about myself, life story, where I was, and I got an interview, and I got two interviews there and basically got offered the role to go and work at Skydive Dubai. So when I rocked up, you know, that at that time, like you said, it was extremely exciting. It was, I sometimes feel like I just missed it by 6 months, the actual peak heyday. But at the same point, when I look back now, I was like, oh no, I was definitely right there in a good time. The plane flight over, something happened. But basically when I got there, now I was not working within a team or for someone. I was there as the creative director. I was supposed to be working within a small team, and the team at that time was it got rebranded as the marketing team. So I rocked up in July, and it was basically around Ramadan and around their off season, so they don't start again until September. So I had a few months to get my feet on the ground, and I honestly spent it in my office at the Palm, which, even to say it now, it was incredible. I had an office on the Palm that overlooked probably 360 degrees of water. It was incredible. But I spent the next few months, because I was serious, I looked through every file, every folder. I got to know that brand inside and out. So the brand had already started development before I got there, and it was my turn to sort of pick up the reins and take it to its next level, which was taking it into merchandise and more events, which Dubai was known for at the time, and the role exploded. I worked within a small team called the marketing team, and I was at the time the only designer until I had too much work that I had to hire an assistant designer, essentially. Now, I was only at Dubai for 2 years, but it was a crazy 2 years, and yes, I miss it. I definitely do miss it to date, but it is probably a little bit nostalgic to think of my time there and the time now.
When I interviewed Craig Gerard, you know, I said, you know, Craig, tell me something that for us unfamiliar with really what is very normal in Dubai, which is might be, you know, the opulence and even, you know, celebrity sightings. And I asked Craig, tell me a pinch me moment. And, you know, he shared his. What was yours? I mean, you just said your office was in at the Palm. But was there any experience in that 2 years, either with an interaction with someone that you couldn't believe you were around, or just the opulence of what you saw and experienced? Can you share some detail there?
Yeah. So there was quite a lot. Now, I'm not huge on starstruck and celebrities and that. Like, I mean, we saw Usher, I saw Will Smith, like all right there in person, shook hands, etc. But I was definitely more starstruck by Craig. Don't tell him that. Craig Gerard is an incredible human being. But for the area itself, Dubai, obviously it's probably well known that His Royal Highness owns the company. Being in his presence was definitely always a very pinch me moment. I got a lot of respect for him. The fun stories, though, I mean, look, put it this way. I have paddleboarded around the Palm and to the Atlantis Hotel and to the Burj Al Arab so many times I couldn't even tell you. I've paddled around Dubai Marina more times than it shows on the Apple screensavers. One time we found ourselves just at the F1 down the road in Abu Dhabi on I call it a boat, but it's a super yacht. I mean, there was the opulence. Yes, it is. It's exactly what the stories that you would have heard. It's incredible. I've actually got so many. I'm my brain right now is just like speeding through the moments. And this is a 2 year period. Again, it was incredible. Some of the things I did see and the people before me, you know, like I said, I feel like I missed it by 6 months. They saw more. Yeah, it was a very incredible time to be there. Like, you know, flying in a, what was the size? It was like a 10-foot tunnel, something, a private 10-foot tunnel. There was so much like I said, my brain is going firing, like just even reliving it while I'm talking to you right now. But for me, I think the fact that I was on the Palm and I got to spend so much time, like the water was obviously part of my life, paddleboarding, like I love stand-up paddleboarding. And for those who don't know, you know, it's basically like you standing on a kayak, but I do stand-up surf as well. But yes, I had the ability to every morning launch my paddleboard at 6 a.m. in absolutely beautiful, clean, clear, silky water and paddle it around the Dubai Marina to the Atlantis Hotel to the Burj Al Arab. And it was usually just me. I did end up doing it with one of my better friends there, Renee, and the drop zone operator as well, Alan Gayton. We ended up, sometimes it was three of us and sometimes it was one of us. And it was definitely the part I missed the most, starting my day paddling around Dubai.
Sounds magical. If you're a fan of the 20-Minute Call, I'd like to invite you to be a member of a budding community with me on Patreon. By becoming a patron of the show, you can join me behind the scenes to discuss options for future guests and gain access to some show swag. It's pretty sweet. Details on how to become a patron can be found in the show notes. Okay, back to the show. So you're at Dubai for 2 years, and then 2014 you start Manufactory. What led you to start your own brand?
There was... Again, a little bit of a course correction there. Dubai was always fast changing, and I had done so much, not just within Skydive Dubai, but for personal projects for the other people who run operations there. Dubai was very well known for if you did good at your job, you would end up sort of getting semi-post by other people. So after I'd done some enormous projects for my management team, I guess I'll just call it that, and the owners, but I was presented with an opportunity to be my own person, be my own brand, start it with my best friend and my wife, or in terms of promotion, and the promotion would be working at quite an elite level within design again, but working for someone. I just took, if I was 10 years younger at the time, you know, in your 20s, you're looking to build your career. Of course, I would have taken the promotion, but I wasn't. I'd been working in now for a decade in a career job, as well as plus another 5 years, like we said earlier, of study. And I was like, I'm ready to make the move. I'm ready to do this. There's a real gap here. Let's go out and try it. I've had some success with Skydive Dubai. Let's try it for other brands and give back to sports, just skydiving, because skydiving, in my opinion, was really behind the eight ball.
As a fellow entrepreneur, running a business is hard. And I often say that maybe what has served me well is a little bit of naivete. Had I known everything that I should have known, I probably would not have got started. But when I think about your business, I shudder a little bit because we're in design. We do a lot of website design, etc. But you're dealing with more variables to a degree, as well as satisfying design, satisfying fit, you know, sourcing materials, et cetera, et cetera. And all of this is subjective. It stresses me out thinking about it a little bit for you. Give me an idea, like, what has been your most challenging day as the owner of your brand? And don't worry, I'm going to ask you your best day in a minute, but the most challenging day, yeah.
No, that's fine. Like you said, hindsight is great. And should I have just taken that elite job? Yeah, for sure. Anyone who's like job, easy. I would say that back in when COVID hit in 2020, which, you know, is 3 years behind us now, it was a funny period because as a business owner, a lot of people will say, oh, you're a business owner, or, you know, you must be doing so well, etc. If you've got orders, or are you doing well? And the hardest part was that when COVID came and we had a team and you are responsible for families and team and staff, and it's such a horrible decision to have to look at numbers, look at future, or look at forecasts and start to make a plan for, well, there's a point there to keep other people safe, to keep the job and the business going. That's when you're going to have to start to get rid of human resources. And that was in 2020. When the world was like a real unknown, That was my hardest bit, is that when you take on, as an entrepreneur, as anyone, like I find that if you're a manager, you're still working for someone, you know, you're still working for someone. When it's you navigating this, like everything in, and even the money, that's when like those decisions are really horrible, because you build a team, like these days especially, you build a team. You find personalities that work together. You find them that you align with. You spend every single day with them. And then all of a sudden, you know, when COVID came, like I said, there's this myth around job security. So like I said, oh, yes, I should have taken that elite job. It would have been way easier. People are really fell for job security, and COVID showed there's no such thing. Like there's, you may as well take the chance. So, you know, a bittersweet moment there is like, oh, I am running the ship, which means actually I'm sort of last one to leave, which is great. I've got my security there. But now you are running the ship. You have a responsibility to a lot more than just yourself. So it was definitely that period was tough, like personally. And any period where you have to make financial decisions as a business owner is always tough. Look, there's problems with products. Something might not have been manufactured right. Maybe you made a mistake on a graphic error and it costs you a little bit of money, like to reprint it to keep a customer happy. But when it comes to having to do things like that, and that's some stuff in business. Like, look, I haven't got an MBA. I don't know if people teach you these things, but as like you said, as a fellow entrepreneur, if you knew what you really had to do in business, you honestly would probably just go, like, hey, I'm just going to get a job.
I've been running Beyond Marketing for almost 11 years, 11 years this January, and this podcast is being released in December. So very close to 11 years, and there have been, you know, the line is not linear, but there are points that were key to driving us forward. What was a sort of a key contract or a key relationship that gave your business life, going, yeah, this is happening?
There are those points. When you phrase it like that, there's definitely key people that we aligned with. And Shelly, who we haven't spoken much about, Shelly, who is my best friend, my wife, Mike, and the co-founder of Manufactory. Everything we do is down the line. Every decision is made together. When we go out to do sales, apart from the last PIA, because we had our little girl, she's there with me, and we are a team. And there isn't a day that goes past that I don't even ask her to check a color. That's how down the line we are. And we have managed to, when we do relationships with businesses and you know, if it's a drops owner or an event, it doesn't matter. We come at it together. We want the best for everyone, and we develop the relationship before we go into a business proposal. So there's a few key ones that I can mention along the way. We've had an extremely amazing relationship with NZ Aerosports, who is now known as Gyro. They've supported us for a very long time, and we really get along with them mindset-wise. Like, we're on the right level together. We've had an extremely successful relationship with Skydive Spaceland, and we think that their business acumen is something that we aspire to, how they operate. And we've met their team, you know, throughout our – we've probably had relationships now with them for 7 years, I think. And we open the door to them. They want something, we sit and listen. We anything that we can help with. We've had a great relationship with Pat Thomas and Sunpath. I mean, they are terrific people. Pat is someone that everybody should have the opportunity to meet and listen to, because she's so genuine. She's there to help. And we really, like, she's helped Cookie. I know that for a fact from the ground up. And she's helped us. Like, we've had leaps and bounds by working with her. So they're key ones. They're the Australian Parachute Federation, I will say. They came on board with us. We developed a relationship early in the days with them. We reached out to them. We showed them what we're about. And then we grew with them, and we were extremely excited to do their uniform time and time over the years, to the point where now we've been extremely fortunate to have the USPA on board. So they saw what was happening, and they've come across to us to develop their uniform going forward. So there's some big manufacturers, big key companies like that, but there's also some really small ones. You know, one of the first orders we had was by, I think you'll know this, Dropsonic, Skydive Durian Bay. And they're the ones who take a chance. They want to be different. They're innovators, like almost early adopters, you would say. And, you know, when I look at my business too, James, mine will be 10 years in January. And over that cycle, when you look at the bell curve, I had a plan. Shelley and I sat down and we said, hey, look, we're going to have, you know, by this couple of years, we will start to get competitors. By this couple of years, you'll start getting copycats. By this couple of years, someone's going to start the price wars on us. You know, we're going to have to make plans to move forward. How do we develop as a business? And that bell curve is very interesting in terms of drop zones as well. If you were to plot that, who first came on to jerseys? Who's only getting to jerseys now? Who's still on t-shirts? That's sort of how I've seen the growth of our business, but also the growth of the industry, because it's pretty much synonymous now that if you don't have jerseys, you're a bit late to the game. It is the uniform for skydiving for a reason now. So there's been some successes, absolutely, and there's been some really small ones who have helped along the way and still stick with us. And they often, more often than not, we've found they're not the business, they are a person. They're someone, and I can say this for my own. Our manufacturing team, I met and knew them outside of skydiving before in the fashion industry, and they've been with us for 15 years. So 10 years of manufacturing and 5 years of my other personal career, that was all personal relationships. And we see customers move businesses. They move drop zones, they move wind tunnels, and they carry on our name. They say, hey, we work with them. They're the ones we want to work with. We take that really personally. Because we understand that they have a relationship with us that says, well, hang on, these guys are the ones we want to work with because of something. You know, now if you ask them, you're going to find out what it is, but we think it's the reliability, the service. When they want to work with us, when they want us, when they need something, we don't want to be big superstars. We're not saying, hey, we're manufacturing, we're the biggest premier clothing jersey brand and, you know, look at us, whatever. No, we're just like, hey, if you need something from us, you send us an email and we're right here for you and we're going to rush it. We're going to find a way to deliver. It didn't work out. We're going to fix it. We thought we would be a little bit more of a, like a little bit more of a brand in terms of maybe first person individual skydivers by now, but we have prioritized our customers, our wholesale base, our drop zones, our manufacturers over our own development, because that's what's important to us, is that we've said from the start, we're going to help you achieve your goals. We're going to help you get your brand out there. And we have always to this date come second. We're at the point where we're trying to definitely come bring ourselves out more into the spotlight. We have a lot of products and a lot of stuff we want to get out there, and we're finding that it's actually the skydiving industry, like I said, with that bell curve, the early adopters and the people who are late to the party now, they're still only getting to jerseys. Well, that's actually slowing down the other developments we could be giving back to skydiving. So we're going to have to prioritize a little bit more of ourselves, because it's going to be prioritizing the industry to move it forward like we did when we first released jerseys 10 years ago now, or even longer when we did them for Skydive Dubai. So, yeah.
Rob, you know, I work with a lot of drop zones, and I certainly endorse you often because I have worked with you. I've been a customer of yours, and your service is outstanding and your product is fantastic. But if there's ever resistance, it's because you're on the other side of the world in Australia. How do you bridge the gap for those that are concerned? I think I'm asking more from an entrepreneur standpoint, as well as give you the stage to say, hey, for the DZOs, DZMs listening, or event managers, how easy or difficult is this separation?
I definitely think that you are right. And I know I'm very aware of the problem that we will get a call up from someone to say, oh, you're in Australia. Oh, we don't want to ship from Australia. Oh, the lead times are too, like, we, you know, it must be on the other side of the world. Our business from day one has been built to be a remote working business. which has allowed us the flexibility to work almost 24 hours a day, 6 days a week by having people on staff to respond. And that's where our customer service has been so greatly appreciated, because we have a 36-hour turnaround time. We also built it to be a global business, because skydiving is global. Therefore, at the moment, our warehousing is smack bang in the middle of, you know, Hong Kong, which is a free export, and is allows us to get anywhere quite quickly within 4 to 5 days. Shipping import duties, this is getting a little bit boring here, this part, but you know, if you ever bought a canopy or a container or a jumpsuit or a helmet, you will have paid these duties. And people sometimes forget that it applies to everything. It's not something we control. It's government-based taxes. I don't want to say that there's ways around these and stuff, like different countries handle them differently. Sweden will charge you 20% or something. Australia will charge you X amount. US will charge you based on how much your order value was. It's very different, but we have an extremely professional team that has dealt with these for decades, and we will get the solution. Now, moving forward, manufacturing has decided, like we have contemplated having maybe a US base or a base in Europe. But how we've done that is that there are very strong, there's distributors around the world that do their job. Mike Gruel from Shooting Star is an absolute machine. We only want to align ourselves with professionals like that. So when I rattle off the list of Skydive Spaceland and Sunpath and USPA and APF, I don't think it should come as a surprise when I'm naming these people. They're at the top of their game. They know what they're doing. They are professionals. So we align ourselves with guys like Mike Gruel from Shooting Star. The guys in Europe, the West Sky guys, if anyone knows those, like, look them up. They will be where we're going to next in Europe. And in Australia, we can take care of it ourselves. So what we're actually going to do now to help with people's concerns is open up these warehouse locations closer to their bases to make them feel a little bit more comfortable. But the truth is, we are in a global, this is the market we should be in. We should be able to freely get, you know, innovative products from Australia to the other side of the world. Now, we do it, we have done it, and we will continue to do it. We also do manufacture on location in other countries. You know, we've had people for events in the US. They need it quicker. We have to manufacture in the US. So we have partners that we have approved. Manufacturing does not deliver anything that hasn't been quality approved and checked. It's not the type of company we are. There are promotions companies out there. There are people like that. They're cost-based driven, and we're just not one of them. If we can't deliver an event, if we can't deliver something to our quality before the price, it's just something that we will turn around and say no to. But that's how we keep our integrity, and that's how we keep our products. But again, we are in a global market, and as a company, we believe that we should be operating in a global market. We shouldn't be operating in this, oh, we manufacture here because of this. It stops the innovation. Like, for us, we're extremely proud of manufacturing our garments in China, where we do, because we believe that they are the absolute best garment manufacturers for garments. If you think about Germans in the automotive industry, or you think about your Swiss watches, the Chinese and the garment making industry today have had longer in the profession of commercial and technological advancements in making garments safer. OH&S, all that is like a thing of the past. A lot of countries, developing countries now, you go and look up where they're made. Well, they're made there for a reason. Like, there are cost cutting right there. There's the questionable labor practices, but then to today, and this is really important for future generations, is that sustainability is huge. And you know, you want to make something cheap, then you got to make it cheap by cost cutting. We are very proud that we're out of China because of a lot of innovation that we're able to produce there. And you know, first world countries, and I'm sorry to say this, but they don't make garments anymore. We don't have a manufacturing industry in Australia anymore. There's definitely not one in the US that isn't taken over the border. And I know a lot of this firsthand. I'm in this industry. I know where the suppliers are and the manufacturing is made, and I know the reasons. And if you want to make something, then you have to have the very best materials, people, design teams, engineers. Like that's how everything good is comes from. And honestly, what comes with that too is people's livelihoods. You can't think that you're buying something for a few dollars and expecting someone else to have been making a successful income along the way.
This podcast is sponsored by Beyond Marketing, the digital marketing agency for the skydiving industry. Now, I'm not a fan of lots of ads during a podcast. I mean, who likes ads? So I'll stop talking about how marvelously wonderful Beyond Marketing is. But if you're curious about what the amazing people of Beyond Marketing do to help drop zones and manufacturers thrive, then you should check out their website at dropzone.marketing. That's dropzone.marketing. It has not been my intention for this to be sort of a commercial for manufacturing. But at the same time, I have been in this industry a while, and I don't want to dodge around the fact that for those drop zone operators or people in the industry looking for a solution, I'm going to straight up say they should contact you because I've seen your quality. I've experienced your customer service. I've experienced the quality. I have manufacturing products. What I was hoping you would share was just the level of detail and your experience, because you really are running a first-class operation. And, you know, no one can see this, but you're on video, and the jerseys behind you that are hanging on hangers are the most premium brands associated in the sport, and they can choose anyone. I want to pivot real quick, Rob. Is part of my curiosity about what you do is I've seen you go to China and to source materials or visit your partners there. And to me, that seems so overwhelming because I've never been, but I just imagine there are so many in the garment industry. Like, how do you suss out the good ones?
Again, that will definitely go back to my fashion industry. In Australia, we have a huge wholesale market, that's sort of where the clothing garment industry is built from. So a lot of it was at the time when Australia relinquished its manufacturing industry. We took it all offshore to China. And basically what would happen is you would go on a buying trip. You would buy all these samples from Japan and LA and New York and the hotspots and grab the latest trends. And then you would stop in, take them to the factory floor, and literally start to break them down and then release them. And that's sort of how fast fashion's these days. That's exactly what happens today. Someone's running around buying something cool off a street from a flea market, saw someone do this, boom, stop into the factory, boom, rip it off, boom, it's in the stores. It's part of the problem. However, that's how it was born, and sort of that's how I then got my footing in to understand how the fairs work. Big trade shows like PIA, but suppliers for everything. One thing that manufacturers always said is like, we'll help you get to where you want to go. We understand that we're sort of like you, James, we're an agency. And when you can take on the workload or decide to take the workload in-house, well, good luck to you. That's great. You know, we're here to help you get to where you want it to go. If you want to stay with us, we will take a lot of that guessing game out, because you want to build a website, you want to start using Meta ads, or you want to start building T-shirts. You're going to fall down. You're going to make a lot of mistakes that professionals can mitigate like we do. And we know the sourcing game in and out. We know who to ask, what to ask, why the relationships are so important in China. I remember a very, very good friend and mentor from Dubai days, actually. I took him on a sourcing trip, and he's a very brash American. He was a definite first-class business person. But when he got onto that sourcing trade show floor, you know, the first question, boom, like a bull in a china shop, what are the minimums? Tell me what the price is. And it's like, whoa, chill. Like, can we just hang on a sec? We know due diligence. We have to build a relationship. They want to know where we're from. We want to know where they're from. Like, you know, otherwise we're just going to get this, like, price, and it's a product, it's an exchange. You may as well be buying a can of Coke. Like, so look, at the moment, if you look at skydiving and the jerseys, at the moment there are people out there who are competitors who have gone out and tried the game themselves. I have been approached by their suppliers I know who they're working with. It's very funny because once you're then into that sort of scene, as big as you said, as big as it is with thousands of factories, it actually becomes quite small. And you can sort of get, you know, people are trying to, and that's like, hey, can we get your business too? And look, this is what we do here. This is what we do there. The partners we have, we've known them because we understand how business works within their culture. So it's very much like, hey, this is a Loctite agreement. This is we're supporting you, support us. This isn't a product exchange anymore. This is a livelihood that we're working on together for both of our families and personal lives. So when you get there, it's overwhelming. It's amazing. It is like running into a market for the first time in Southeast Asia. But as well, you've got to know what you're looking for. So you mentioned materials a few times now. The materials, the fits, you've seen, well, you've heard from my earlier discussion, like Shelley and I are both in fashion. We've known this from the ground up forever. We know what we're looking for. We have that advantage. We're skydivers building skydiving products, and we're fashion designers building fashion products. I mean, we're pattern makers building our own patterns. You know, like you said earlier, we've just got everything that needs to go into knowing what we're doing. But we believe that because we didn't just come in here to as a side hustle or something. This is all we've wanted to do, and this is what we're doing. So it's really important to us. And to be educated, I would suggest anyone who wants to be an entrepreneur, anyone who wants to run a drop zone and be a business, is you have to get a bit of an education behind you in there before you take that leap. Otherwise, you just have to be prepared to fall down a lot more times, I think. I wouldn't say don't do it. It's definitely, the risk and reward is much bigger as a business owner. But for anyone who wants to do something, if it's building a t-shirt or whatever, or go to a fair, you need to build up experience behind you a little bit just to, I would say, save yourself some of the pitfalls and the money expenditure that you're going to put down.
Fascinating world. I'm intimidated by it because there's so many, as I mentioned earlier, variables. Let's pivot away from business for a moment and talk about adventure from the standpoint that between the places you've traveled with your business and being in fashion to places like Dubai and skydiving, as well as adventures in Australia, tell me a story of an adventure you've been on through all of these experiences that when you recall it, it makes you smile.
I would love to give you sort of a cliched response where I'm like, hey, I've been to Dubai, or Shelley and I found ourselves in Florence, or we found ourselves in Paris. They're like travel stories, right? Or we shot a film clip here or something. But the truth is that I did not ever see myself being married or having children or a family. It's never been on my radar. I've been quite a driven person. Shelley's quite a driven person. And the thing that, to get a little bit almost sentimental, is that we got married. We've spent our entire, entire adult lives together almost. And Shelley and I, we got eloped, which was one of the most incredible days of my life in Italy. We have done a lot of this shared stuff together, everything. But what makes me smile is we had a little girl recently, Charlotte, who's 3. And the truth is that parenthood was something that took Shelley and I very much by surprise. It is, I mean, I would take on multitudes of businesses before. Like, parenthood is insane. And the thing is that when you see parenthood from the outside as a 20-year-old or something, or in movies, you're always highlighted by like, oh, the pregnancy and, oh, my God, those 9 months and screaming babies. But that's, oh, my God, that part goes in the blink of an eye. And what comes from that is that every single day is the adventure. It's just insane. It's never repetitive. Your question is just so perfectly formulated for this reply, because – what adventure makes you smile? And I could tell you about all these cool little travel trips and all these luxury stays or not, or, but that's not, that's the things that I've done. But the thing that makes me smile every day, and I'm sorry, but it is, it is my family, my little girl. It changes every day. And if I have to think about it, I never think about the bad stuff. I think about those, the moments that, like, she makes me smile the second I'm brought up. And I, you know, I can't wait to, we've taken her to the tunnel already. And when she's at the drop zone running around, and when she's running over my parachute lines, or falling over in my paraglider, you know, like, she does make me smile, and that is the adventure. And I know that it might not resonate with a lot of people, especially like those who aren't there, those who have no, those who just want a wingsuit base jump right now at their life, but that's where I am in my life right now.
I'm smiling from ear to ear as I listen to you express that. That is awesome. I'm always interested in what personal development other people are into. Namely, with the books that they're reading or the podcasts that they're listening to, what's one of the best books you've read or that you're into right now? And the same for podcasts, barring this, of course.
Of course. No, it's not a commercial. Personal development. Actually, you know what? I've been quite a strong believer that when COVID did happen, if you weren't spending that time upskilling, you were wasting a lot of time. The one books I'm always buying and I'm into are actually businessmen or women autobiographies. Like, I love to read about how they got there, the actual grit behind what they did. And they have a lot of grit, but a lot of the time they have a lot of mentors too. And they're the ones I want to see, like, because they're the ones who are giving out some great information. Also, self-align. Am I cut out? Am I not cut out? What have they got? You know, how can I resonate with these people? So business people books are the ones, they're the ones that really drive me. They're the ones that I really love to grab a handle on. But then that led me into a lot of autobiographies. Like, I did Matthew McConaughey's Green Lights, and I've done like Anthony Kiedis's Scar Tissue from the Chili Peppers. I've got quite a few, actually. I ended up reading them, and then I've given them out to other friends who are inspired by them. I never get them back. But I love those ones. I love to read about people, I would say. But the people I have to, like, I think Dave Grohl's not going to hear this, but, like, Dave Grohl's, it was too much fluff. It was a book. I didn't feel like I really connected there. His earlier life was pretty impressive. I love to hear about that, but I don't know, maybe I was expecting a little bit too much from him.
Rob, you and I are very similar. I love autobiography. I definitely will grab a business book. Like, I love Shoe Dog from the guy that started Nike, Phil Knight. But what I've found, I really prefer to hold a book. But when it's an autobiography of someone, that's when I like listening to the audiobook, because you hear that expression and that tone and that passion. I love it. But those books you mentioned, that Matthew McConaughey book in audio, hearing him speak with that Southern drawl, it's all right.
I didn't think of that with that, because, yeah, like, I mean, I did the audiobook thing for a while when I was traveling a lot. So I used to love putting on the audiobooks or podcasts to walk. Like, I can't do it when I work. But I think the last audiobook, honestly, I did do, if I was being honest, was like Eckhart Tolle. Now, that is a voice, James, that is definitely no Southern drawl there. But that was something to take on a different level. So audiobooks, yes, I love those. Podcasts. Now, if I was to talk about podcasts, I've had a sort of love-hate relationship with quite a few of them. I've tried to do – I'm not too fussed on the podcaster, like, say it being like a Gary Vee or a Joe Rogan, most popular ones. I've tried quite a few other ones. I'm not really interested in the podcaster, but I'm interested in the person they're interviewing, because I feel like the more popular ones, they end up being quite repetitive in the, I feel like there's an agenda they might have there. Whereas the interviewers can come in and you get to learn, very much like that autobiography. Like, I do love anytime I can see like an Elon Musk being on a podcast or something, it's the people's stories I want to hear, the people's interest there. So that's sort of where I get that. There's a few out there I've tried in terms of, like I said before, martial arts or sports or even airplanes. I've tried to get into those sort of things, but it's just not where I want to be, because, like, if you listen to an autobiography and someone speaking at, like, you know, like I remember Joe Rogan interviewed Kanye West. I was pretty interested in that one. I think he's an exceptional talent. But the thing that I like about it is that I had a disconnect. I was like, oh, I'm not a big fan of where he's going with this. And then all of a sudden, and like I said earlier, that I'm not a very starstruck person because people are just people. People are just like they've had opportunities. And that's what I like about it is like you get to like you read about them, you think you admire them, and then you see them or hear them and you're like, oh, okay, And it brings you back into perspective, back to reality, and to remember it's just a person. It's not the be-all and end-all. So that's probably why I think I might even give that green light a second shot to hear Matthew, because again, reading the book, I have my own interpretations. I'm sort of like, you know, I'm sitting in there playing it up in my head. So yeah, thanks for that.
Yeah, what was it? By the way, I have to mention, I don't know if it resonated with you as it did me, because I'm very fond of Australia and the Australian culture. But hearing him recount his experience being in Australia, living with a family that was pretty tough, was fascinating. But hearing him recount it, fascinating. Let's pivot. Last question. Always fascinated to hear about a crossroads moment in someone's life where had they not said yes to that opportunity or that decision to do the most mundane thing, that if that thing isn't done, maybe you and I are not talking right now.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny that you say if I had not said yes, though. If I had not said yes, would we be here? Well, my best friend, Shelley, probably thinks I say yes too often. She probably thinks, like, I say yes, I will help you way too often. And there are a lot of moments, again, like I mentioned earlier, I had an opportunity to start for myself, or I have an opportunity to go work for someone, you know, in a completely different elite level. And honestly, I don't think we would have ever met if I took that road. I've had the opportunity to say, yes, I will go move to Dubai, or no, I will stay here and work in Melbourne, and I'll earn more money and I'll be able to support skydive. I've had quite a lot of those, and I believe that you should say yes as often as you can. I think that we do say no out of fear, but to sort of like, not to get too on this, I've done a lot of work sort of on my own self-awareness, because I've been very driven my whole life. I know where I want to go. So when I do say no or yes, it's very much a decisive moment. Is this going to take me to my place, to my goal? So there's been a lot of opportunities that I've had to say no to that are amazing opportunities by themselves, but they never got me to the place where I needed to be for myself. I know that's not giving you a definitive moment, because there has been a lot of times where I could have, but I recognize within myself that my answers have come from my own values, and my direction, and try to be aware of, are you saying no because you're scared? Which is definitely something that, you know, well, there could be a lot more entrepreneurs in the world. There could be a lot more opportunities had. And so recognizing in myself when it's important to say yes or to say no, but there's been plenty of times where you and I could not have crossed paths. Could have been as simple as just saying no to going to an event exhibition. Could have been no when you rocked up to the, when you had your time in Australia, and I could have just said, no, I'm too busy to sit down and meet this guy. Or, you know, there's a lot of chances to say yes or no, and I think you just have to recognize, do they sit with you a lot of the time? But I'm very glad I've said yes many times to get me to where I am. Yes, I can help. Yes, I can do this. And at the moment, I'm recognizing that time, as an entrepreneur, as a business person, I'm sure you'd account this yourself, time is something that you don't get back, and it's very difficult. So to say no at the moment is actually a little bit more beneficial than to say yes.
Rabbi, whenever we speak, I always feel gratitude. I feel like you're my brother from Australia, because I'm very driven, you know, and I want to do right by my clients, and the relationship is important. And so the thing about this podcast for me is it gives me the opportunity to get to know people that I am friends or acquaintances with to go another level deeper. You know, our relationship is such that when we meet up at a PIA symposium every other year, which is only then extended with, you know, a COVID situation, you know, we're both doing business at our booths and then we'll grab a quick dinner. I have learned so much about you in the last hour, and I have really, really enjoyed it. Thank you so much for sharing to me. I feel this is a one-on-one conversation, but also to everybody that's listening. And I'm grateful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, James, for the opportunity. It has been a one-on-one conversation. To be honest, I would share any of that information with anyone because I've been told throughout my whole life I wear my heart on my sleeve, so I'm pretty much an open book like that. But yeah, look, I look very forward anytime I get to chat to you, and I look forward to seeing you again in the flesh for that quick dinner, because it is always a highlight when I get to hit the ground in the States and catch up with you.
It's mutual. Thank you, my friend.
Thank you very much.
Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to the 20 Minute Call podcast. Please do follow us on your podcast app so you always have the latest episode, which is released every Monday. If you want to contact the team, our email address is podcast@beyondmarketing.xyz. This episode was edited and engineered by Garnet Znydrick of the YouTube channel Blue Skies Fun Days. Thanks for listening, and join us next week for our next episode.